Hello and welcome to Culture Power Politics. I'm Jeremy Gilbert. I'm here once again with Alan Finlayson. Say hi, Alan.
Hi, Jeremy. I'm live from Norwich.
He's live from Norwich. If you don't know what this podcast is about, it's about culture, power and politics. Go to culturepowerpolitics.org for more information. A big thanks to everybody who's been supporting, giving us moral support with all those five-star ratings and putting hands in pockets where it's possible to keep the lights on. It's really a big help and a big encouragement.
I didn't know we got five-star ratings. Do we get five-star ratings?
Yeah, we've got loads. You know, what's really interesting is, well, I knew this, but we weren't on Spotify for years because I just, especially, I teach in a music program and musicians quite rightly all hate Spotify. It's an evil platform, but...
Oh, but have you sold out?
But we're on, well, people, very good friends of the show, like, kept bugging me, saying it's inconvenient that it's not on Spotify. I listen to things on Spotify. And we've only been on Spotify since September, and we've got nearly as many reviews on there as we've got on Apple Podcasts.
Oh, I didn't know. I'll have to go and check it out.
10 years. So
how are we doing kind of competition-wise? Who's more liked, you or me?
It doesn't say that.
Damn.
It doesn't indicate.
Damn.
That. You know, obviously, I'm the man. All right.
Yeah. All right.
So people.
There's a 30-year-old competition we're in here. I'm not giving up that easily.
I mean, like the authority figure. You know, I'm the producer and the.
Oh, I see. Okay, so I get the full insurgent vote.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point. So today, is it an emergency? It's not really an emergency, and we're getting ready for the upcoming local elections. And also this afternoon, on this very sunny the sunniest afternoon of the year so far, we're going to be doing a long recording session about religion in politics. But before we get started with that and have our first tea break, we are going to do a little update on contemporary politics. And where things are at. Just ahead of the local elections, the big local elections are coming up next week. And the week after that, in fact, if you're listening to this in real time or shortly after it goes out, Alan and I will be doing live podcast recordings covering the local election results, both in person in Bethnal Green on the Wednesday after the election result, So that's the 13th of May, 2026 in the evening. And then a couple of days after that, we'll be doing a Zoom call for any podcast listeners who want to participate live but can't get to Bethnal Green on a Wednesday evening. And you can find information about all that if you go to culturepowerpolitics.org, find the menu and go to upcoming sessions. You'll find links to where you can book for those or go to those. It's all free. But the local elections are coming up, but let's go through, we've got some notes. We've basically got a list of topics. And the first thing Alan put on the list was Mandelson, as if that hasn't been covered enough extensively. I guess it probably never really can be. There can be no end to what can be said or should be said about Peter Mandelson. So Alan, what's new in the world of Peter Mandelson?
Well, last time we talked, that was just when he had been forced to resign and things had broken about his involvement with the Epstein. Since then, there's been all this shenanigans about who knew what when and about the vetting from the Foreign Office, that the Foreign Office didn't pass Foreign Office vetting.
So the question is
who knew that, who, when, etc., etc. I mean, I partly put it on because I'm actually intensely irritated by all of that. Partly because I'm going to sound like I'm on Team Starmer here, but I'm not clear that anything particularly wrong happened.
No, I agree with you.
As I understand it, the idea of these deep vettings is by the Foreign Office is they get done by an independent agency and they're not meant to be released to figures in government, which makes perfect sense because you're trying to keep separate political interest from private information you might be finding out about people who are being considered for civil service posts. You precisely don't want information to be held against them. So why would you tell political appointees that when you ask someone about their affairs or their past drug habits or etc. So that's one reason for it. And secondly, it seems to me not unreasonable for the Foreign Office Civil Service to say, well, since this person's already been appointed and approved by the Prime Minister, it is precisely not our job as civil servants to tell the Prime Minister who they can and cannot make an appointment. So there is a constitutional issue about the confusion between a political appointment and a civil service diplomatic appointment. But clearly,
well, we need to specify for people exactly what's happened, because some people will listen to this 3 months in the future and then everybody will already have forgotten the details.
Well, go on then. So give us one of your updates then.
Well, I can't. This is one of those things I can't. I'm not even sure I can remember already. The head of the Foreign Office basically has been sacked.
Yes.
Was that right?
Yeah, he's been sacked because it came out that Peter Mandelson didn't pass, or there were flags raised at his security vetting for the position of US ambassador. The Prime Minister has said that wasn't the case, then said he didn't know that had happened. And so he sacked the Chief Civil Service at the Foreign Office for not telling him that had happened. And what I'm arguing now is that not happening is not necessarily a big problem, but the Prime Minister deciding to kick out the head of the Foreign Office for doing so is a problem. But all of it distracts from the simple fact, which is that the government chose to appoint their friend to a position, an important political position, because he's their friend and they owe him one, when he was clearly wholly unsuited to it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think the way it's been covered is pretty revealing. The way it's been covered by most mainstream news journalism, it's been covered in such... I mean, I do think on the one hand, I agree. I think Starmer sacking the guy for what was, you know, at best like a poor judgment call in a very complicated and difficult situation, I mean, at worst, was clearly wrong, it was clearly unfair, and it was entirely consistent with his totally vindictive tendency to sack people, going back to Jeremy Corbyn, having the Labour whip suspended because he wouldn't say exactly the right form of words about the IHRC report. So I think that's the case. But it's also the case that apart from that, you know, a lot of the coverage is trying to persuade it is like a competence issue, like Starmer's not being a good enough manager.
Yes, exactly.
You know, he's not on top of all the details, like as if anyone can be on top of all these details. And that is that, of course, that's a deliberate distraction from the political question, which is the problem. Exactly as you said, the problem is they should never have been on the agenda to appoint Mandelson, whether as US ambassador, whether there was a security red flag or not. And also, that's also not why everyone hates Starmer and wants him to stop being prime minister. Everyone hates him, wants to stop being prime minister because they want a fundamental break with the legacy of Thatcherism that his government isn't offering them.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I mean, but this is playing out in sort of interesting ways, I suppose, in that it's clearly affecting it as if it needed it, the local elections. It is building into that picture of administrative drift and incompetence. It's also concentrating the minds of the Parliamentary Labour Party in a big way, and I think their hostility is cohering around it somewhat. So I think it will have effects in that. But it's also provoking some of the Starmer stans who've now resorted to the defence that their man is just getting really unfair media coverage.
Some of which is true, yeah, some of which totally. They can leap on. But yeah. Also, but Starmer stand-up in the media has become kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
I already mentioned this on the last podcast, I think, well, the last but one, I think, that will be in the feed when I did on my own. That video that's been going around of the New Statesman interview with Mark Gatiss, a British kind of actor and dramatist, we're saying, I can't see it. Starmer's obviously a decent man. I can't understand why all the hate for him. Everything's basically fine. It's like, no, it's not.
Yes, I didn't understand that. I
think things aren't basically.
Yeah, he specifically said, I mean, the trains are running on time. I think I saw that. I was literally on a train that was 30 minutes late, wondering if I was going to make my connection. So,
if you're like elderly, you know, a kind of, I guess he's sort of elderly Gen X with no kids, with who's still got a job in the creative industries, then you might think everything's basically fine. I don't really understand. I honestly don't understand, actually, how someone who can be so involved with the BBC as Mark Gatiss can be so stupid. Because the BBC, just like every other public institution, has sacked hundreds of people in the past few years. And is you know, everybody who works there is miserable because the whole place is falling apart. So I don't how you can think that. I just don't know. Well, I do know how. It's because, you know, he has his own kind of independent production company, as people do, you know, that still gets plenty of commissions, and he doesn't have any kids, so he doesn't have the experiences which I can see now is the experience which is radicalizing a lot of people in his socioeconomic position, the position of their graduate children coming home from their elite universities unable to find jobs or housing. So he's not none. If none of that is happening to you, then you can be in this sort of bubble. But it's kind of crazy. But what was striking was the reaction, the kind of social media reaction to this, because of course it seems ridiculous to people, and it just seems to exemplify a kind of, you know, late Bourbon France level of elite complacency. But I think you're right about, I think the Labour, I think you're right about all, I think you're right about all this anyway. I think you're completely right. I think let's come back to Labour leadership in a moment, because obviously the big news story, the thing we're building up for, the thing we're planning, we're taking the risk of thinking we're going to have two kind of live recordings worth of interesting things to say about in a couple of weeks, is these local elections. And I keep saying to people now, I can't remember a local election being this anticipated. Or seeming to be this historically consequential, like in my life. Can you?
No, it's hard to, isn't it? I mean, I suppose we should modify that by saying, because we've said local elections, it's only local elections in England. It's national
it's
elections in Wales and Scotland.
Well, yeah, so
I think it's also the conjuncture of those things, which are going to be very significant in their own right.
But yes, I
think part of it is a bad thing, if I can just say that. And I think there has been a sort of, because as we subordinate ourselves more and more to American political culture, we begin to think of local elections as like midterms, the every 2 years elections for the US Congress and so on. And so it looks like, you know, we treat it as a referendum on the government, which I think is a problem, because, of course, that's not what's going on in Scotland and Wales. It's not a referendum on the London government, or not primarily. And I think it does underweight the importance of local government, which does deal with most of the services that people are probably most in contact with. It's where the front line of their relationship with the state is. Social services, lots of schools, if not all of them, adult social care, planning, local policing. So I think it's a shame that we don't think about it in that way. It gets treated as just a kind of referendum. That said, I think it is because the contradictions and shifts of British politics that have been bubbling under, possibly for our lives, the shifts in voter behaviour, the volatility of electorates, the fragmentation of the party system, which I've been expecting to manifest itself unambiguously for 20 years, and that didn't manifest itself partly because of the Corbyn period that shifted the dynamics a lot and brought Labour back up, partly because of Brexit and the ways in which that led to new alignments around particular polls that brought us back to two-party competition, and the very peculiar circumstances of the July 24 election. But I think in this one we're going to see absolutely unambiguously the claim that you or I have been making for a long time, that this is at minimum seven-party political culture, is going to completely play out. And the two main parties, as we still call them, are probably going to come third and fourth in England, and maybe even further down elsewhere. We'll see. So I think that it is a expression of things that have been building up for a long, long time.
Yes, I think that's all true. I mean, I don't think local elections in Britain being treated as midterms is that new. Mm. I mean, it was already a thing in the 80s, like when we were teenagers. You know, the local elections were paid attention to, and I also think, I think we need to explore this whole issue a bit around, like, what motivates the way people vote in local elections, and what's its connection to the actual politics of local government? Because I think, I mean, the standard thing which people who know more about politics than most people like to say is, of course, it's true. People vote in local elections on national issues, and that seems inappropriate because a lot of the time, you know, rule just logically, you should be voting on local issues. You're voting for people on the council. But my response to that is always to say, well, look, we live in a system in which local authorities, as I'm always saying, have less freedom of movement in terms of tax raising, budget setting, and general policy than any equivalent municipalities in like what are considered the kind of advanced capitalist democracies in the world. Like, there's nowhere in the world that has as weak local government as we do, or as centralised a political system, or in which central government exercises as much day-to-day power over local government. Therefore, it's perfectly rational for people to vote in local elections on a national basis, because actually it's the composition of the national government that has more effect on local government outcomes than anything local government is able to do. So I think that is really so that that does create a sort of paradoxical situation. I mean, I know like for me locally, it creates this. I feel like I'm in a very paradoxical situation. Just as an individual voter, and I've heard quite a lot of other people, like with sort of identical politics, I think, saying very similar things, which is, well, I live in Waltham Forest in northeast London. I think it's been a solid Labour council for over 50 years. I'm in Waltham today. My MP is Stella Creasy, who was seen as a kind of, you know, exemplary figure of the Blairite right, until a couple of years ago when she got very visibly worried about how well the Greens did at the last election, which was only getting 20% of the vote, you know, and Labour getting like 60 odd. But it was also, you could see, well, if that was an increase from about like 4 or 5% of the vote last time, and if there was an exponential increase along similar lines, and they'd win next time. So, and of course, you know, she's always been kind of factionally on the right of the party. She was very, you know, almost embarrassingly, you know, vehement in her opposition to Corbyn and Momentum in the Corbyn years. On the other hand, she has actually been voting for left positions in Parliament, like a lot of London MPs have been doing, as a socialist, as a Marxist, like I'm not interested in what's in her heart. I'm interested in what she does politically, you know. So as long as she keeps voting for the left, then, you know, she's being successfully disciplined by democratic processes. And I don't really mind whether she stays an MP or not. And similarly, at the level of the council, the general consensus, I mean, it's kind of interesting amongst sort of friends and neighbours around here, I would say, people who were really involved, more than I was, in the politics of the local party during the Corbyn years, and have all left, or been expelled or suspended from the party, absolutely hate and resent, you know, the current Labour councillors, who are all factionally linked to the right wing of the party and always have been, and enthusiastically endorsed or were complicit with the purging of various like left-wing members of the party, including councillors, during the early years of the Starmer leadership. So they really sort of hate them, and they are going to be very happy to see them go if they go, like, for those factional reasons. But, and with those people, I have to say, I mean, these are like good friends of mine, but it's quite hard to have a kind of straightforward conversation about putting aside those issues. Like, do you think there's actually stuff they could have done as councillors? Like, do you think there's policies they should have pursued that they haven't, or they could have pursued that they haven't? And I'm never really able to get a very straight answer about that from people. And then the consensus among a kind of broader network of people who were never really very involved in the politics of the Labour Party, like people who were, you know, really on the kind of radical left, is that especially people who work in things like social services, education, local government, is that, well, yeah, overall they're not bad. You know, they haven't pursued a bad program. They pursued a program which, you know, we've got one of the best recycling programs in the country. We've got we've got all the low traffic neighborhoods implemented. We've got all the schools have not been forced into academisation. We've got a higher concentration of schools that are still community schools than is typical now of the country for that reason. So They've tried to keep, they've kept an impressive number of libraries open. Like, some have closed, but compared to a lot of places, more have stayed open. Even in terms of affordable housing, you know, the situation is like disastrous compared to any kind of ideal. You know, I don't know how my kids will be able to stay living around here. That's helping people. But within the parameters set by, you know, national government and the housing market, they're perceived to have not done a bad job, really. And I think that is true. And I think that is even true of my local councillors, who they include at least one person who, for internal Labour Party factional reasons, I would not vote for if she was standing against Nigel Farage. But it also includes people who I think are basically okay. You know, I think they made a big mistake in their lives in becoming factionally associated with the kind of Labour First network. I think they probably didn't really know any better. And I think they're basically decent people who will vote the right way if on most things, like if given a chance. And then the Green Party, which like, it, I mean, to be clear, like I'm not, my overall analysis from the left of the global political situation in Britain right now is, look, if I'm going to be consistent with what I've been saying for years, which is the principal obstacle to political progress in Britain is the organised, entrenched power of the Labour right. And that was always historically my argument for being in the Labour Party, because that's where you find those people. That's where you can get up close to them and fight them, basically. Well, now, according to the same logic, it's now perfectly rational to say, well, actually, like the Green Left strategy seems like it's working, and the best chance of like wiping out a big chunk of the right wing of the parliamentary Labour Party, and the best chance of taking out on a national scale a big part of that Labour right wing network, which I was pointing out years ago, had its real roots in the network of local councillors. The best chance of doing that is voting Green, is using the Green Party as like the hammer with which to beat all those, you know, to destroy that edifice of the Labour right, which has done so much damage in the past few years. And so for those sort of strategic reasons, I mean, I have thought, I'm still, you know, I think it's quite likely one day I will end up joining the Green Party. I haven't done yet, but I've thought about joining the Green Party, and I've thought locally, you know, the thing to do is for people to vote Green, and we should all be voting Green, and the thing to do is to get them. It's just get rid, just destroy the power of that Labour First centred network. But I've been really disappointed by the Greens local campaign. The Greens local campaigning has basically been presented in terms that they could be Liberal Tories. You know, the issues they're telling us we should vote for them on are, they're saying we're going to have clean streets and affordable housing. To which my response is, well, do you think the reason we haven't got those things is because nobody thought of it before? I mean, they're basically presenting themselves on this vague sort of a vague appeal to competence and this idea, well, that there must be change. And I to me, that's not consistent with the clarity and honesty of Zach Polanski's kind of national campaign. Like, if they were saying, actually, Waltham Forest Council has done a pretty good job, like, given the constraints on them, but it's not enough, and we need councillors who are going to really campaign locally and nationally against the continued austerity in local government. We recognise even that central government is increasing local government funding, but it's only a drop in the ocean. We need to campaign. If they were saying we're going to implement really radical policies, like the sort of Preston Council type policies of using local procurement strategies to encourage like cooperative businesses, etc. If they were saying stuff like that, I'd be really enthusiastically voting for them. I'd probably join, but they're not. They're just saying, I mean, I think the coded message is, look, we all hate Labour. Let's just punish them, you know, and we won't run the council any worse than they would. But that's disappointing, and it is. And I've spoken to quite a few people in different parts of the country, like, you know, friends of ours, like in the past couple of weeks, saying very similar things, saying, oh, well, I really want to vote Green because of what's happening at the national level and because it's the obvious thing to do strategically. But locally, you know, the messaging is like stupid. It's completely stupid, frankly. And it's just it doesn't really make me feel inspired at all. And it makes me feel like, you know, well, why would I vote for you? Like, you know, why would I vote for you when we've got a fairly decent Labour council? And I wonder to what extent all that's going to be played out at local levels in different parts of the country.
That's super interesting. That's super interesting. I mean, so partly because I think, yeah, what you're showing, though, is the way in which local elections are always a complicated relationship between the national picture and the local, specific things that you know and feel about where you are and what's going on, and maybe even about the people who've been in council. And sometimes, yeah, that's part of what I was getting at earlier. Sometimes we interpret the local results in a local election without necessarily being aware that it was all about, I don't know, in Norwich, it might be all about Debenhams in the city centre and who's going to get it and how many student flats will it be? These kind of things, which become emblematic in a town or a city, but also, of course, linked to the big issue. But what you're saying there is that you're sort of put off not by the national party, but by the local party. But is that, I don't really know enough about how the Greens work. How much of that strategy is designed by the people in Walthamstow Greens, and how much of that
is totally designed by them? It's okay. All completely autonomous. Yeah. And it's, you know, and it's in a way, it's impressive that they've got on operation, and like their main propaganda, there's been a leaflet, but their main propaganda tool has been a video that's gone around on Instagram, which I think is good. And I think I've been disappointed in the past few years that there hasn't been more use of social media and short form video, mm-hmm. like in local election campaigning, because I think it would be a really good way of livening up local elections. So I'm glad that they're doing it. But then the content of the video is just, it's time for change. We're going to make the streets clean. It's like, well, why is it time for change? And how are you going to do that, given the budget, you know, given the budget constraints? And given the streets aren't particularly dirty around here either, that's the thing. Everybody always wants their streets cleaner than they are. Like, but unless you live in a completely different country, or you live in one of those Tory boroughs where the only thing they spend money on is cleaning the streets, then they don't really get, urban streets don't get any cleaner, much cleaner than Walthamstow's. So I don't believe them.
I mean, it doesn't sound so different from the pitch being made in Norwich, which is partly centred on kind of Norwich is kind. It's a kind city, diverse, creative, etc., and aligning itself with that sort of cultural attitude. But that's partly because the fight for the Greens is very much a fight against a relatively entrenched Labour city council. It's a bit different.
But isn't it also because reform has got more chance there?
Well, that's it. So, I mean, Labour seem to me here to be fighting it very hard. I've seen a lot, just in terms of a lot, I've had a lot more Labour leaflets, and I've seen a lot more Labour posters and banners. I don't know that translates into anything beyond that, but they're certainly presenting it absolutely 100% as them versus reform, and that's partly a blending of the county fight and the city fight. I mean, it's complicated up here. I mean, there's been some kerfuffles because some of the Greens at the county level have opposed solar panels. there's a lot of conflict outside of Norwich and around. I'll rewind it. One of the reasons the Greens won in Waveney Valley in Suffolk Norfolk border was because they opposed pylons, which are carrying electricity from renewable sources. And they would say that's about, you know, protecting the natural environment, and why does Suffolk have to have these pylons when it's going underground in richer parts of the county, that sort of thing. And the criticism here was that, well, there's a lot of conflict over very large or seemingly large solar panel installations that are being put in and what they'll do to. Obviously, part of it is people's concern about house prices and traffic and so forth, some concerns about nature and so forth. And the Greens have opposed it, but partly on the grounds that it's not community-owned. And it's, so they've tried to put it as, you know, this is international corporations coming in and doing this rather than it being community-owned. But it's partly about trying to win that so-called NIMBY vote, I think. But here is also complicated because, as you say, reform is a challenger in parts of the city and the county, particularly we've got city and county at the same time. And to make it even more weird, these elections are partly delayed from last year. But in 2 years' time, we will have a new Norfolk-Suffolk mayoral authority. So we'll be in a completely different council situation. The council we're electing will not exist in 2 years' time. And next year, there will be elections to a so-called shadow council. So we will elect people who won't be on the council, but will be learning how to do the job as we go through the transition. So, to my surprise, sort of almost none of that has really featured the fact that we're about to go through an incredibly significant, I think, transformation. And part of the game underlying this is people building up for what they're going to do in that new council situation. Because I think there's a strong possibility that we get a reform mayor elected in Norfolk and Suffolk on a very low turnout of the vote. anyway, this is a bit sort of off the topic of where we were naturally, but I think it's good to remember that part of what is going on is very local and very specific and very immediate things that are fed through and fed out of the national picture. The national picture, we know, is predicted to be possibly the greatest number of Labour councils lost ever.
Yes.
I think that's the figure.
It is, yeah.
And particularly I think there's
relatively little question of that.
Yeah.
I think the latest, the most extensive MRP, the multimodal regression polls, which try to really predict by comparing national polling changes with local demographic conditions and using large samples. That's got, I can't remember, I haven't really been paying attention to how many Reform are going to win, because that's your job. I was predicting around 1500 for Greens, which I think it's probably going to go higher. If I had to bet, I think the Greens are going to win more council seats than even people are expecting, over 2,000. So, but I think also that could well not happen. It'd be interesting to talk about why it might not happen.
Well, so much depends on the nature of the tactical vote, which is part of what's confusing in local elections. Certainly, it's not necessarily clear, say, if you're in Norwich or Norfolk, who do you vote for to stop Reform winning?
No, exactly.
And at that ward level, those MRPs don't really help you very much.
No.
So people will be, and everybody is, or not everybody, lots of the leaflets are trying to say we are the ones who can beat Reform between the Green and Labour.
Yes, yes.
There's clearly kind of moves of Conservatives to Reform, I think, in terms of voting. That seems to be happening as well. So that block voting will come out ever more intensely, and part of what will drive the result is who people think will be the candidate or the party to beat Reform in their area.
Yes, I've got a good anecdote about that, actually, which is... Now, I can't remember if this was on social media or a WhatsApp group, or I was just talking to someone. I can't remember who I heard this from a couple of weeks ago, but it was somebody in Islington. It was someone in their house, like a family member or a housemate, saying they were going to vote Labour. And the person they were talking to is a big Green supporter, but they said, oh, no, I'm going to vote Labour to stop Reform. Now, you don't have to know much about the demographics of British politics to know there is zero chance of a single Reform councillor ever being elected in Islington from now until doomsday. But this is also an indicator of the fact that, yes, firstly, turnout at local elections is always low. You never go, I think, like 37, 38% is like the ceiling,
yeah,
usually.
Yeah, if it's not a national election, yeah.
Yeah, and it's often lower. But even amongst people who do vote in local elections, actual knowledge about local politics is very low. So people, I mean, when you do polls of people to find out, do they know the names of their MPs, the names of their local councillors, etc. I mean, I'm thinking the number of people who could probably tell you the names of their local councillors, I'm thinking the percentage is probably single figures, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So there will be loads of people voting in these local elections entirely on national issues who don't even know really what the situation is locally. Like, there will definitely be people voting here in Walthamstow, even in one of the more affluent bits of highly gentrified Walthamstow, who don't know anything about local politics, and they might want to vote. They might be inclined to vote Green, but they also know they hate that horrible Mr. Farage. And they might vote Labour for that reason. So if I think, like, and I would say, if the Greens don't get, as many as 2,000 or even 1,500 new councillors elected, that will be one of the major reasons why. One of the major reasons why is the message that you must vote Labour to stop Reform as a kind of centrist blocking move has been quite widely dissipated. And the anecdotal evidence is that Labour has gone hard on that message in a lot of places, and it probably does resonate with low information Guardian readers, you know. Yeah. So that probably that will be the thing, actually, because I also, the flip side of that is my sense generally is that the reason I think they'll greens will do really, really well, and I think possibly even better than those MRPs are predicting, in places where there's obviously no real threat from reform, because the level of anger, the level of rage at Labour, and the desire to give Labour a kicking amongst like a huge section of their natural traditional electorate now, I think is my sense is the vibes are that I think that is even more intense and widespread than the polls are picking up. Probably. Because I just think so few people are going to be motivated to come out and vote Labour. I think the Labour turnout is going to be lower than the polls are allowing for.
There's a possibility, isn't there, that some of the excitement around reform and around Greens does bring out some more people. I mean, reform are clearly pushing to agitate their base to come out, and that might have some effect. But there might also be Labour voters who stay at home because they can't bring themselves to vote for anyone else but aren't happy. Similarly with Conservatives. Yeah. So I think there might be some fluctuation, but it would be pretty astonishing if the turnout was above 35% in overall, it may be higher in London. I don't know if there's more attention, excitement.
Well, it might be.
Yeah.
And then the devolved election, I mean, the situation in the devolved assemblies doesn't really look like, I mean, the predictions around that seem more consistent and more predictable. It just doesn't really look like there's any chance of Labour surviving in any meaningful form in the Welsh or Scottish parliaments, does it?
No, the picture I get from Wales is that it's very much a Plaid Cymru reform straight fight. There's some evidence that reform might be picking up, actually, as we head towards the polling day.
I won't believe that Wales will vote mostly for reform.
It depends. I mean, as kind of Conservatives decide to move that way, when the phenomenon of block voting becomes quite intense. There's also there are some specific issues. I know that there's actually quite a lot of agitation around the 20-mile-an-hour speed limit that the Welsh Assembly brought in. Lots of people don't like that and might want to protest against that by voting for reform.
Is that all over Wales, or is it only in urban areas?
It's urban areas all over the country, yeah.
Okay, well, stop moaning. It's only in urban areas.
Yeah, but that means that people are very conscious of it every day, right?
I know.
So you can see how if they don't like it, they're going to be reminded of it every single day. And you know, the abstract argument of this saves money and saves lives in the long term is going to have a hard time against that, but I'm really irritated every morning I'm trying to go down this empty road or whatever. But I raise it up because it is kind of more of an issue than people might realise outside the country, as well as kind of, you know, the standard issues that we'd expect. There's also lots of uncertainty there about the voting system. It's a new voting system. And neither experts know how it will play out, and there's evidence.
So what is the new voting system? What is it?
As I mentioned it, I thought he's going to ask me to explain it, and I find it very hard. So they have had it in the past. You got to cast a vote for your assembly constituency and a second vote for a list that topped it up and made for proportionality.
Yeah. It's now the additional member system that's used in lots of... basically every new body that was created by the Blair government use that system, because that was basically the system which the Roy Jenkins's commission had recommended for should be put to the people as an option for the House of Commons in the referendum that the Labour 97 manifesto had promised, and but that never happened. Blair government reneged on that promise flagrantly, but as compensation that you basically use that model in all the new bodies they created and in the European elections, which is how people are, you know. And for the Greater London Authority, which is how we ended up with people like Zach Polanski being voted for by people like me voting Green for lists where there was a chance of them getting elected. Sorry, I'm just putting the context. Anyway, that was the system.
That's a good context. Yeah.
So now what's happening?
So it's a very different one. There's going to be, partly because there's going to be more members afterwards, it's going to go up from 60 to 96 or something like that. But I forget. This is terrible. I'm a political theorist, not a political scientist. But I forget what it's called. No, it's meant to bring about more proportionality. Essentially, what will happen is when you vote, you won't have two votes, you'll have one vote. But what you'll see on your ballot paper will be a list of parties and then a list of candidates for each party, rather than seeing, as you would in England, a party label and a name. There'll be a party label and a list of, I think, eight candidates for most of the parties, maybe plus some independents. And you'll vote for the party. And then the seats will be allocated by a D'Hondt system, so a complicated mathematical formula meant to ensure a maximum plurality and proportionality as you can, going down that list of candidates. But what that means is it becomes a bit more unclear how you might vote if you wanted to vote tactically. Presumably you would just put your party down, but it might be more complicated than that. So, and it's unclear how much people understand it, or let alone campaigners and voters. So that may have some effect on how it comes out.
Yes, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
All right, we shouldn't dwell on this stuff any more, because as I said, we're doing like two events about
it. Yeah, we are sort of anticipating things.
Yeah, we're anticipating. We'll be repeating ourselves again, and we can talk about
housing rights, though, since it is May 1st.
Yeah, let's talk about that. We'll talk about that, and then we'll finish talking a bit about the Labour leadership, because one has to. Yeah, well, today is the day worth mentioning. We're recording on May the 1st, May Day. Happy May Day, everybody. And today is the day that the Housing Rights Act has come into effect, which means that basically British renters, British tenants, now have some of the rights they lost. Quite a lot of the rights they lost, actually, in 1988, the Thatcher government restored. And it does mark a significant shift in the balance of power in favour of renters in a way from landlords. It's not as significant as would have been restoring local authority power to impose rent controls, which is the thing we really want. But it's pretty significant, and it's one of the most radical reforms that this government has made. And I think it is interesting. Of course, one thing that's worth noting about it is it's not actually... I mean, Angela Rayner wants to claim all the credit for it. Like Starmer wants to claim all the credit for it. I mean, this is actually something that Michael Gove and Theresa May wanted to do as well. Because it was recognised... Even a certain strand of Tory had realised a few years ago that the situation had just got out of control, basically in terms of the legal framework, balance, you know, putting a finger on the scales of the market in favour of landlords. And so it's arguably, it's not that radical. Given that in a context in which Michael fucking Gove wanted to do this.
Oh, it's his middle name, isn't it?
You could have done something a lot more radical, like bring in rent controls. And they haven't done that. So I'm not inclined to give them that much credit. But I think in a way, to me, what's interesting about the situation is, you know, their image as a government that just isn't doing enough, isn't really doing anything, doesn't have an agenda, like is barely touched by this actually quite radical move. But I think it's, you know, it's symptomatic of the extent to which, you know, their position, like the position of the Biden government, is that They sort of do understand what people are really upset about, but they really can't bring themselves to even start addressing things on the scale at which they need to be addressed. And so they bring in these reforms, which are genuine reforms. They're genuinely moving away from the long neoliberal direction of travel, but they're just not dramatic enough to actually convince anyone that it's going to seriously improve anything. And of course, I mean, as well as rent controls, you know, what we really need is a massive increase. We know, look, the history, you know, the jury of history has given its verdict. Like, we know the only thing that can really constitute the kind of intervention in the labour, in the housing market that is required is a massive programme of public building of social houses. Like, historically, all kinds of things have been tried by governments to intervene in housing markets. It's not the first time there's been a housing market with a government. You know, that's been a thing for 200 years. There's only one thing that really does it, and that is a massive increase of supply of social housing, non-profit social housing. Anyway, what do you think?
I don't disagree dramatically. I do feel maybe a bit more generous to them. I feel a bit sorry for them, because I think it is, you know, it is a good act, and there is very good things in it. And sometimes
good.
We can be a bit harsh, because, you know, if, as you say, if Gove Trust Tories do it, we'd all be like, amazing, these Tories are doing this really good thing. But because we sort of expect that from Labour, we have a higher bar, we get a bit more critical when they don't do it, although your criticisms are completely well made. But what strikes me then is their inability to actually make it land in any way. And I don't know, you know, part of that is a reluctance to trumpet it as a radical progressive.
Well, I think Starmer tried. Starmer did a little spiel last week. I can't remember what the context was, saying, look, we are the most radical government since the 70s.
Yes.
Like he actually said that.
Yeah.
And he listed all the things, including the housing rights and the mild restoration of workers' rights. And like it's true. They are. But then that's. I mean, that was the hook for my New Statesman article in December, though. Like I was saying, to understand the political conjuncture, you have to understand, that is true. And yet,
But I think you're right to say it's partly a kind of a. What is required and what people want is something more radical than the most radical government since the 1970s. That's one of the factors that's doing it. It is also their inability to...
Well, this is also the thing. It is an important point. It's not the most radical. It's the most progressive.
Oh, okay.
But it's nowhere near as radical. Well, no, I'm not correcting you. I'm thinking, I think Starmer used the word radical.
Yeah.
But the point, I think he did, I might be wrong, misremembering, and we're using that term. But of course, it might be the most progressive. But the trouble is, its progressiveness does not anywhere near meet the radicalism of the level of reaction engaged in both by the Osborne-Cameron austerity regime and by Thatcher for years. See?
Yes, that's fair. So, but what the second thing I was going to say, though, it's also their inability to articulate these things in any way that makes them become... more meaningful to people, and I know it's easy to overestimate the purely symbolic dimension of politics, but this, this could have been a policy you presented as both a good policy in itself and as symbolic of a much larger ethical, ideological, political, economic aim, and it simply doesn't do that, let alone connect to other kinds of areas of policy. So they're missing that bit where these things are also something that we can feel connected to, as it were, existentially, as part of a direction in which we, the country, are going. And because they so completely discount that element of politics, there's the debate about the housing bill is dominated by people saying this is going to harm landlords, it's going to cause rents to increase, et cetera, et cetera. And they don't really come back fighting on that. Their own desire to present their policies as significant yet also fundamentally technocratic cuts off their own legs, really.
Yes, well, I think you're right, but I think we keep coming back to the same point, and we probably will do, like, until things change. You're right, they could have presented this policy in a different way, just as you described, but concretely the only way to do that would have been to say, look, eventually, we do want to build like a million council houses. Like, eventually, we do want rent controls. Like, this is the first step, of a long journey. Yeah. And they're absolutely not going to do that, say that, because they don't want to do it. They don't want any of those things. And they would absolutely rather not do any of those things. So,
but that's really striking, isn't it? For a party leadership that also claims to be the sort of pragmatic rationalists who want to keep power so you can do good things, because them not doing that is precisely what is harming their electoral chances, as we will see on next Thursday.
Yes, well, all that is true.
So what happens afterwards? Well, again, we don't want to say everything that we're going to say after it actually happens, but I did.
Well, let's just talk about. No, sorry, go on.
No, well, I said casually to somebody the other day that, without even thinking, that I said, "Oh, Starmer won't be prime minister in 8 weeks," and they said, "Oh, I'm going to hold you to that." So I've been thinking now, have I made a public commitment to Starmer not being prime minister in 8 weeks? But I don't think he will be, or at least if he is, he will have said he's stepping down by a certain time. Do you think I'm being too rash?
No, I think that's all. I've always thought that was the most likely outcome.
Yeah.
I mean, these things go back and forth, don't they? And I was on the LRB, the London Review of Books podcast, a few weeks ago I've completely forgotten her name now, with the woman who used to...
Emma Burnell and James Butler, was it? Was it
no, him? no, it was the other guest.
Sienna Miller. No, it's not Sienna Miller. Sienna Rogers.
I always say Sienna. Sienna Rogers.
Sienna in a minute, yeah. Sienna Rogers.
I'm going to leave it in, it's funny, because I always do. I always call her Sienna Miller. I've always say that when I'm referring to her.
I don't know exactly who Sienna Miller is.
She's an actress.
Yeah, I know she's something.
Sienna Miller's an actress.
I couldn't pick her out from a lineup.
No, I know. It's just it's an easy to remember. So I'm very sorry, Sienna. I'm really apologising publicly
in case I don't
have the time or energy to cut this. I don't think Sienna knows who we are anyway. So Sienna Rogers. No, well, she's very good, and she was. I think she was the first editor, or she was editor of Labour List for a long time. Very good. website, very good source of information about the internal politics of the Labour Party. And she was saying she thought maybe Starmer wasn't going to go this year after all, possibly, because at the time, a few weeks ago, there was all this noise from the PLP about, because he was comporting himself in such a dignified way on the world stage and standing up to Trump and not fully endorsing the war in Iran, then actually, and we don't want a change of prime minister during the kind of economic crisis that the war in Iran is in the process of precipitating, he might not actually go. And at that precise moment, I still said, well, that might be the case, but statistically, I still thought the most likely thing was that he was going to go. But I could, there was a few weeks, I mean, as I say, we're 1st of May 2026, and a few weeks ago, there was a period of a few weeks when there was a lot of the talk about Starmer definitely going after the Gorton and Denton by-election had died down, the war in Iran had just started. And there was general talk about how there wasn't really a significant challenger, especially because Burnham had been blocked. And my feeling then was, it looked like that might be the case. It might be the case Starmer might stagger on at least for another year. But if that was the case, it wasn't a sign of like his strength. It was a sign of the complete morbidity of the Labour Party. That is, you know, if you can't renew yourself, even to the extent of getting rid of an obviously disastrously failing leader, then you really are a dead institution. So that was one way of understanding it. But I think now, I think you're right. The vibes around Westminster seem to have changed again, partly because of the Mandelson issues we were talking about earlier. I think his sacking of, what's the guy's name, the senior civil servant from the Foreign Office?
Ollie Robbins.
What's the guy's name? Ollie Robbins, that's right. Yeah. I think the sacking of Ollie Robbins, it has really reminded people in the Parliamentary Labour Party that Starmer does have this, you know, track record of vindictively punishing other people for his mistakes to the point where he can't really be trusted, like even on their own terms. And that is really shifting the mood.
Definitely. So, and I think it's going to come out so bad. Even though everyone's expecting it, the confrontation with the results and the number of people, and yeah, there will be members of the PLP will be with their sitting councillors who will be distraught and upset at losing, you know, councils they'd worked very hard to maintain. That's going to spill over into their feeling, their outlook, isn't it? But I think,
that's true.
Is there not a possibility we end up in a weird situation though, where, you know, people who want Burnham to step in will have an incentive to keep Starmer on for long enough to have Burnham elected, whereas Starmer's own faction will have an incentive to get him to go as quickly as possible to call an immediate leadership election and try and get West Streeting in place?
Yes, all that is possible, but there are some kind of predictions and assertions I will stand by, and one is that Streeting is finished. Like I know that the gossip from Westminster this week is that Streeting has 100 MPs who are willing to nominate him, that they're all ready to go for a campaign after the election results, and they don't believe that his supposed association with Mandelson will taint him. I am sure all that is true. I'm also sure every single one of those people is a moron who will be shocked to realise how much his Streeting's association with Mandelson will continue to taint him and to taint them in the minds of their own electorates once it becomes public knowledge, as it will, that they've supported his bid for the Labour leadership. Mm. But it would be exactly consistent with the idiocy and the worldview of the right wing, of the already incredibly right wing Parliamentary Labour Party, for them to have convinced themselves that they can get away with trying to campaign for Streeting to become Prime Minister when he's very unpopular and he is publicly associated with Mandelson. And then when it turns out they can't, and when it turns out that local political rivals, either within Labour or from other parties, start using the fact of them supporting the Mandelson associated Streeting against them, to be all shocked and surprised that such a thing can be happening and outraged about how unfair it is that local constituents are noticing something they're doing and having opinions about it. So I think Streeting has no chance of becoming Labour leader, in my view. I just don't think there isn't, because I don't think even the surviving rump of the Labour membership who haven't gone and joined the Green Party just are not going to elect him. And it's going to be even the ones who were telling opinion polls a few months ago that they would like Streeting to be leader. Half of them now, after the Mandelson stuff, won't vote for him. because they'll see that he's going to be toxic electorally. So streeting, I'd forget it. It's not happening. I believe like the spectacle of him and his supporters thinking it might be possible might well come on the cards. And I just think if they force the hand of the rest of the PLP, then they will just get behind Rayner. They'll just pragmatically they'll do it, because why not? Why wouldn't they? Even if Rayner only ends up being prime minister for a year and just kind of usher in anti-Burnham. It's just, why wouldn't they? Because it would be so easy. This thing, if Streeting actually challenges and gets the nominations, then we're going to see a situation where it will be the easiest thing in the world for Rayner to get a different 100 MPs to nominate her and have the membership elect her. And even if she doesn't really fancy being PM for more than 6 months till they can bring in Burnham, which is possible, just why wouldn't they? Like, why wouldn't you at that point? So that's all possible. It's also possible that I think everything I'm saying is right, but it's possible that the Streeting people will realise that. It's possible that their private polling, which they will have loads of because they've got loads of money, will show them Streeting just is not going to become prime minister. You know, so and they'll give it up. Like, it's possible that that will happen, and then we're going to be back in the situation where there's going to be this, you know, what's going to happen? Like, Rayner's the obvious person, but ultimately she's never really wanted to do it. Burnham's obviously the only person who can actually maybe save the Labour Party, but he's not an MP yet. Getting him to be an MP is a big hassle. And then you've got to deal with the fact that there's all these people on the National Executive Committee who don't give a fuck what happens to the Labour Party as long as they get to stay on the NEC for another year. And in that case, I think we don't really know what's going to happen. And things could just stagger on in a condition of like chaotic stasis for another 2 years.
Well, on that bombshell, maybe we should take a break before we turn to God.
Yes, let's do that. We've done our update in less than an hour. But strap in
20
once
minutes.
We have those results. Once we have those results in, we can pour over the results. We can pour over the MRPs, which will be produced on the basis of the results. That's one reason I want to leave it. I wanted us to leave it for a week after the results before we start doing stuff, because I want to see the MRP polls that will be based on the results, predicting, you know, hundreds of Reform MPs. So, all right, thanks very much for listening, everyone. Thanks, Alan. We're going to stop this recording, have a cup of tea, and start talking about God, gods and sin.
All right. All right.